Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. Tom Moran here from Tom's Big Spiders. So today we're going to be talking a bit about Pisa Letheria ornata and kind of Rufalata as well. They're the two big Pisa Letheria species. I just did a video featuring three of my ornata being rehoused, and this is kind of the director's cut. I like the podcast because I can go into a little more detail than I normally can when I'm sitting there trying to rehouse three fast, very venomous spiders trying to keep my concentration. So this allows me to kind of kick back and add a little bit to the discussion. But before we get into that, I did receive an email from Julia Hurley about the previous podcast where we talked about, amongst other things, the worry that the hares could bother our dogs. I had somebody ask if I ever worried about my dogs being hared accidentally or inhaling the hares, and we went into that. However, we actually have somebody here who had a situation where it sounds like her dogs were hared. So anyway, here is what Julia writes. After listening to last week's podcast, I wanted to share a story. Quentin, my beast smithy, escaped from his enclosure for a total of 41 days. After he'd been missing for about a month, our two-year-old German Shepherd was rubbing her face and eyes a lot, so I took her to the vet. The vet thought that she was beginning to develop panis, which was worrisome because it's a condition found in older dogs, not young ones like ours. Fortunately, the symptoms resolved, and when I took her back for a recheck, her eyes looked fine, no sign of panis. A few days later, my daughter spotted Quentin on the wall near the dog's food and water dishes. Mind you, this is down an entire floor and at the other end of the house from his enclosure. I'm pretty sure he went looking for water and was sharing her water dish. I'm also pretty sure that the dog's panis symptoms were actually caused by Quentin's urticating hares, and he had a bald booty by the time we recovered him. We were very lucky that neither animal had a worse outcome from the situation. Thankfully, both have been fine ever since. So that's like, A, I'm so glad you found the spider. 41 days is a long time to be missing one. I can't imagine the stress that must have caused, hoping that spider would pop up. I've, over the years, been privy to a few cases of spiders getting out and them finding them later on. One of them, it was several months later and they found it. So awesome that you got it. And then, again, it does sound like what you're describing was probably what happened. It was around the water dish. The dog came over, maybe sniffed it, saw it, what is this big thing crawling over my water dish, and got a face full of hair. So I'm glad that obviously your dog was okay. I'm glad the spider was okay. And that's just, again, more evidence to the fact that the hares are no joke. They're no joke for people. They're no joke for pets. So we got to make sure that, and when we're doing our rehousings and our maintenance, especially maintenance, I think that's the spot I know where I've slipped up before and I've suffered for it. You're doing maintenance. It's a new world species. It's been in that enclosure for quite some time. It's probably dropped hares once or twice. A lot of times they'll go, when you rehouse them, they'll kick down hares around their area to kind of protect themselves, mark their territory, so to speak. And the hares, when you go to change them or move the enclosure and change the substrate to clean up, can become airborne. And that's easily when you can end up with hares all over you. I've had it happen before where, I'm scooping out substrate, dumping substrate, puff of dirt, and in that dirt are the hares. And later on, my neck's itching, my arms are itching, my hands are itching, my fingers are itching. And we have to remember that when we're doing that, our dogs, our animals, our cats, whatever we may have around the area could definitely be impacted. So thank you so much for chiming in on that, Julia. Again, I'm glad it ended well. And thank you for showing us an example of what can happen if a dog were to get haired. So today's episode, as I said earlier, we'll be talking about Pisa Letheria ornata. I got to be honest, I don't do a lot of episodes based around one species because in my mind, it limits the amount of enjoyment the audience can get out of it. But I've had several people come up and say they don't care what I'm talking about. They play the podcast from beginning to end. And I've had some folks go, listen, you did one. I had zero interest in that particular species. And then years later, I came back and I went, I'm really interested, and went back and listened to the podcast, and it was useful to me. And I think that's kind of something that I miss sometimes, is the fact that, yes, there's some people right off the bat that maybe they're listening to it going, I'll just listen to it even though I have no interest. But it becomes important later on when maybe they come around and they go, I want to check out this species. It's kind of the same thing with my videos. I've noticed that some of the videos I put up, they get a modest, you can tell which species are more popular than others by the numbers you get, like how many people end up watching the video. And I'm not obsessed with numbers by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just more interested in, all right, I put this species up. I think it's obscure. Yep, it's obviously obscure because very few people jumped on that video to watch it. However, what happens is years down the road, those numbers keep going up because eventually some people go out there and they decide, hey, I'm going to check this species out and let's see what Tom's got. And they come over and they find the video. So it all works out. So I may be sprinkling more of these in. I was doing a lot more of them at first. I pulled away from them, but I'll try to always add some type of topic at the end that we can talk about. And this does have a little message at the end that I would like to discuss. So anyway, Piece of Lotharia or Nada, I ended up getting three beautiful little second Instar slings from Emil. If you remember, Emil and Aaron were on the podcast ways back to talk about the Tarantula Sustainment Project. That's a project that's, this is a U.S. thing. Other countries aren't going to really have to worry about this, but in the U.S., we have some rules surrounding which species can come be imported legally into the country, which species can be sold across state lines. And again, I always put this disclaimer in there because I think people hear me talk about this stuff and assume I'm 100% on board with it. I'm not. The way I see it, stopping us from being able to sell the Piece of Lotharia species we already have in the country across state lines does nothing to protect them in the wild. However, I am somebody who enjoys the hobby. I am somebody that respects the fact that the law is in place, whether I agree with it or not, and that we need to abide by it. And I have mentioned before, and we'll get to this toward the end of the podcast, the fact that if we keep doing stuff illegally in the hobby, it's going to bite us in the butt. There's a lot of us that believe that somewhere down the line, the hobby here is really going to change because there's going to be some new rules that really make it difficult to get some of the animals that, in some cases, we've had here for decades. But we'll get to that a little bit in the end. So anyway, Emil actually gifted these to me. And a gift means that there is no money. I'm not paying him for it. I'm not buying something else. He's giving them it for free. He literally said, "Would you like to have three of these?" I said, "I would love to have three of these." And I offered to pay shipping because, again, shipping is expensive, but it was just the straight shipping cost. That's it. He packaged them. It was beautiful. There was a little letter talking about how the fact he was abiding by the rules set down by U.S. Fish and Wildlife. These were a gift, no strings attached. I loved it. And I think that's the way things should be done. So Emil sent them to me. He's been a class act. He's a sterling example of how people should be in the hobby. He is trying to make sure these spiders remain available, even if future legislation starts to kind of crack down on how we can trade them. So back to the Tarantula Sustainment Project, it's a way to track these Piece of Lotharia species and even the Brazilian species now, because that's another one that's getting a little iffy. We had a big scare several years back where we couldn't import them. They were afraid, once again, to sell them across state lines. It got very scary because some of these species have literally been in the hobby for decades. So Emil and Aaron Cashel, the one who sent me all the Ephebopus or Ephebopus species, have put together basically this database, a website database, allow folks to say, this is the state I'm in. These are the species that are on this list that I have, so that folks can hopefully track people down to find breeding loans, to continue making sure that these species remain available state by state. I think it's an awesome thing. I every once in a while try to find a reason to promote it so people know it's out there. And I will obviously put a link to it. I encourage anybody in the U.S. who thinks they may have some of these animals to check it out. Even if you're not planning on breeding right away, put your name down in there, let them know so that at least the option is there down the road if you decide, hey, you know what? I have a Piece of Lotharia fasciata, and I have a female, and I would love to get some of these in my state. This is a great way for you to, when that time comes, if you decide to help out. So anyway, I digress. I got two of these guys in, two Instar. Emil had emailed me, and he's like, "Hey, they're pretty good size," and they were. They were really good size. Normally, for Piece of Lotharia species, if they're smaller ones, I usually start my Piece of Lotharia species in large dram vials. The ones are like 3.5 inches by, I think the diameter is probably about, I'm trying to size it up, maybe 1.5 inches, which I'm guessing is around 3 or 4 centimeters or so. And those are usually good. I put in about 1 inch or so of moist substrate, some sphagnum moss, a little, I set them up like I would in a boreal, but keep in mind, and I've said this many times, Piece of Lotharia species to start off will do a little digging. They're not going to go full fossorial, but they'll dig behind that cork bark. They'll pull up some dirt, which will end up on the surface. They'll use some of that moss and dirt to create, and their webbing to create curtains. We call them dirt curtains around the cork bark hide. And then they usually have a little burrow entrance and they hunt from there. And that's where they hide when they get disturbed. They go down in there. So don't expect, tip number one, when working with any Piece of Lotharia species, but we're talking about the Ornata here, don't expect your spider is going to be sitting out in the open like those beautiful pictures you see of them when they're just sprawled out on a wood limb or tree limb, or where they're out on a cork bark, round or flat, and they're just looking so picturesque. They're going to hide first. These are shy, shy creatures, and I want to make that very, very clear, especially once we get into the temperament department, that shy is the first word that I would always use to describe Piece of Lotharia. So normally I would start them at something like like that, but he did give me a heads up. They were pushing, you know, he said one of them might even be an inch and a quarter. So I started them in 20-ounce deli cups, which I think I've talked about before. I used to use the hobby staple for slings are the 16-ounce deli cups for the terrestrial species, and then a 32-ounce deli cup for a fossorial or a boreal, which are great. We've all used them for years. I've used them with a lot of luck. However, I found that sometimes with the smaller, especially smaller fossorial species, the arboreals not so much, but the large 32-ounce container can sometimes be too big. You're going to fill it with, you know, 3 or 4 inches of substrate. You put a little teeny tiny sling in there. What it's going to do is burrow all the way down to the bottom. And that's when you have those situations where they burrow, they fill up the burrow. They're expecting there to be prey items under the ground. Prey items don't come. They don't surface. And then next thing you know, you have a sling that's starving because it's not coming up to get the prey you're dropping on the surface. So I did find these 20-ounce ones, and I love them because they add a little extra depth from the regular 16-ounce ones, but they're a little more shallow as opposed to the 32-ounce ones. So they're kind of the best of both worlds. I've used them for fossorial species, and they work great. You put a couple inches of moist substrate or substrate in there. They can do their burrowing. You leave some space up top for them to bring the soil up. If it's a smaller arboreal species, I did have 3 Somopia species in them, and then 4 Pisolatheria species in them. All of them start off as like 3/4-inch slings or so, 1-inch slings, and it worked great for them. It was just enough depth to allow them to do what they needed to do, but not so deep that I lost the spider in the enclosure. But that's not to say a 32-ounce won't work. It'll work just fine. I just like the 20 ounces. So I put these 3 initially into 20-ounce enclosures, about 1.5 inches of moist substrate, cork bark hide, the sphagnum moss all around, made a little area. I always shove some sphagnum moss behind the cork bark. That I found allows the spider, if you put a piece of cork bark in there, if it's around, I like to shove a little sphagnum moss in there, use the back of a paintbrush and kind of open a little hole in it because it makes it nice and tight and cozy, because the spider is going to want a tight and cozy spot to settle down in. I found that helps them settle in much more quickly. If I'm using the flats, I lean them at an angle against the side of the enclosure and then I shove a little bit of that sphagnum moss behind it again to make it tight and cozy. And I found a lot of them will end up right there. They start moving the sphagnum moss around. They build a nice little den. It works out great. And that's what these guys did. So they started off around 1 inch or 2.54 centimeters. They were growing at a decent clip. I've mentioned before, I'm not as aggressive with my feeding schedules anymore with my tarantulas. I used to feed slings twice a week. There are still some I feed twice a week, but some of them I'll feed once a week, a larger meal. Now, these guys were good hunters, and I found that most of the Pisolatheria species I've kept, the only ones that were a little more timid, I went through a stage with my P. metallica, the first P. metallica, that one was a little tricky to get to eat sometimes. If you put in something too big, I mean, this was something that I would have dropped in with any other Pisolatheria species, it would have been all over it. My P. metallica seemed to be a bit scared off and skittish. Sometimes it would go weeks without eating, sometimes a couple months. One time it went like 4 months without eating. Finally, I tried it with a prey item and it ate again. So go figure. But that one was a little on the skittish side with eating. And then my 2 Pisolatheria subfuscus, Highland and Lowland, originally I had 4 of them. One of them ended up being male for both of the species, but they did the same thing. They were a little more timid when it came to eating, but these guys have been hitting like trucks from day one. So I started them off. I was feeding them the Red Runners, small Red Runners. I started off with nymphs. Those were a little small, so I went a little bigger, you know, like 1/4-inch nymph or so, or 3/8 of an inch nymph, and they were eating those no problem whatsoever. They put on a decent amount of size. I mean, I was looking at it. We got them in October 2022. They're not even a year old yet. They're getting close, obviously. We're getting there. But they are now right around, all 3 of them are right around the 3-inch marker, 7.62 centimeters. So decent size. I've had other Pisolatheria species grow more quickly, but like my P. regalis put on massive size very, very quickly. But I'm not feeding them as aggressively as I used to. Back when I got my Pisolatheria regalis, I loved feeding my spiders. I was one of those ones that probably fed them, if there's such a thing, too much, because you get bored, you go in, go, all right, I have it. And this is when I had probably less than 50 spiders. there wasn't a lot. You feed them all, and then you're like, you want to do something with them again. So I'd feed them again, and I'd feed them sometimes 3 times a week. I don't do that anymore. So that could explain the fact that they aren't growing as quickly as some of my others. I did, just before I started doing this podcast, I looked over at the YouTube video comments. I've been trying to keep on them, and I did get a comment from Emil who said his are about the same size as mine. So that sounds about right. And as this is a large Piecelotheria species, a large spider, I'm assuming that there's going to be this point where they take, a lot of times with the bigger spiders, there's one molt in particular where they seem to really jump in size. So I'll be curious to see if these guys do it. So speaking of size and growth, this is considered to be, by many, the largest species of Piecelotheria currently available in the hobby. The other one would be the Piecelotheria rufolata. I've heard they're similar in size. I've heard some people say the rufolata get bigger. I've heard a lot more people say their ornatas get bigger. I will say that as far as evidence of how big they can get, someone did send me a wonderful clear photo of a P. ornata molt spread out with a tape measure, and it measured a solid, and probably even larger, but a solid 10 inches or 25.4 centimeters. That is a huge, huge spider. And you think about it, if the molt was around 10 inches or so, then the spider's got to be, we'll give it, usually at that age, that size, you don't put on a great deal of size with each molt, 10 and a quarter inches. So that's a big spider. That's a giant spider. So these are giants. Rufolata is the last one. Mine right now is, I think, around the 9-inch mark or so, right around there, maybe slightly smaller. Someone did show me a molt of one of theirs. It was around the 9.25 inch mark or 23.5 centimeters. So both of them huge, huge spiders. Now, just the size of these spiders can be intimidating enough, especially for somebody who's not used to working with the giants. However, both of these species have garnered a reputation over the years for being the most high-strung and potentially defensive Piecelotheria species. So we have, obviously, a genus of tarantula that is often demonized, although I think we're getting better with it. It still takes some time to convince people they're not as bad as they're made out to be, but let's call it as it is. Any Piecelotheria species, potential for amazing speed. They can move. They are thin, lithe, athletic spiders that, if motivated, can move very, very quickly. They are also widely recognized as having some of the worst venom of all tarantula species. So now you have something that's fast. You have something that could really, if you read some of the bite reports for the venom, not everybody gets this, but these symptoms can be severe. We're talking about excruciating pain that radiates through the limb, vomiting, heart palpitations, cramping. I always share this. I read one story where somebody got bit by it. They were feeling a little bit better. Arms still hurt, even though painkillers wouldn't touch it. They went to bed and they felt their body start cramping from their toes on up to their calves, like full Charlie horses. Anybody that's gotten a Charlie horse before in their calf or in their thigh knows how incredibly painful that is. And this person described how it went up from their calves to their thighs, to their stomach, their abdominal muscles, their glutes, and then finally to their chest, to the point where they felt like they were having a hard time breathing and they were worried about their heart. So this is, and I'm throwing this out there just because I never want to downplay the potential, again, keyword potential, risk for this. You don't want to mess around with these guys. That's never been anything that I've encouraged. They deserve respect. And that's something that needs to be considered when keeping them. Some people just decide even just a minute possibility of getting bitten by them is not worth it, and I understand that. But I don't think bites are inevitable, and I don't think they're necessarily even likely when working with these spiders. However, the P. ornata, P. rufolata, have the reputation for being a bit more bold, a little more bratty, shall we say, when it comes to the adults. There, I've heard instances, not anything over the top, super aggressive, so to speak, but there's some defensiveness that have caught out. They can be a little more bold. They're larger spiders. I've heard people say they've thrown up threat postures, and that can be intimidating. You're working with a potentially 9 to 10 inch spider that's throwing up a threat posture, that can jump, that can move very quickly, and with the threat of that venom. So I think they're the ones that a lot of, it's weird because I get more folks saying, I want to keep my first pokey. I'm looking at ornata and fasciata because they love the looks of them. And then on the other hand, I get a lot of folks like, I'm never going to keep these species, those two species, because I'm afraid of getting bitten by them. So it's this weird kind of, some people seem to not get the memo. Some people get the memo too much. I haven't really had trouble with either, and I had a just a little history with my keeping of ornatas. I had a female ornata that was about 8.5 inches or so. Not, I don't think, fully grown, but it was one of the ones I rehoused on substrate that I'm pretty sure it was contaminated. And she ended up getting super, super fat. I was waiting for a molt, and she ended up just dying. It was awful, and I was so upset. And then before the Sri Lankan ban came into effect, I picked up two more. Fear Not Tarantulas had them in, and I grabbed a bunch of the Sri Lankan species I could before that ban went into place. And both of them turned out to be males, and none of them were bit. My female was very, very laid back, fairly visible. You'd open her enclosure, she'd just sit there calm as can be. It was just a wonderful, wonderful spider. And the two males obviously can be a little nasty usually. And because they're a little more high strung, they're looking for a lady, they're more active, and mine were very, very laid back. But that's mine. And that's not to say somebody else might not have one that is a little more defensive. So that needs to be kept in mind. Temperament wise, I have not seen any real differences, but I have to listen to other keepers when they say every once in a while when I put something up about an ornata or a Rufalata, somebody will come on and go, yeah, mine's a little bit spicier. Mine's a little bit more defensive. Not terrible, but you know, you need to be aware of it going into it, that as always, temperament can differ from spider to spider, from specimen to specimen. So I may have the most laid back P ornata anybody's ever met. Maybe it's one of those ones that if I was handling, I would handle her, and somebody else might have one that you got to be a little extra careful about. So just keep that in mind. So anyway, they hit around the 3-inch mark, which made them, you know, a bit too large for those 16-ounce deli cups. Here's where the deli cups, the shorter or the more shallow depth kind of comes into play, because once they put on some more size, I went to feed one day, I took the top off, it kind of skittered around, and it almost, because the top of the webbing was so close to the top of the deli cup, it for a split second looked like it was going to bolt out of the cup and then went down to its burrow. And that was like, all right, heads up, Tom, it's time to rehouse this one, enough playing around. So at that point, I realized it was time to rehouse them. Now, for my juveniles, you can put your juveniles into anything you want. For years, somebody just asked me about this, for years, I used the main stay 1-gallon containers from Walmart. They are they make gorgeous terrestrial enclosures. I once had at my old house in the old tarantula room, I had this shelf that was just, I think I had 15 of them on it, and we called it Arboreal Row. And it was all the arboreal specimens up in those beautiful crystal clear containers. They look great. They're very easy to ventilate. They are inexpensive. I want to say they're $2.50 each. I think they're right around the $2.50 mark, or maybe $3. They might have gone up, maybe even $5. Even if they're $5, they're not that expensive. And what I would do is, because there wasn't a lot of floor space and I didn't want to reach my hand into that container with a potentially defensive arboreal species, I would take plastic cups, clear plastic cups. I would cut one of them so it was about 2 inches deep or so. I would make a little hole in it. I'd make a little hole in the side of the container up higher toward the top. And then I would take a hot glue gun and I would squirt a dollop of glue through the hole in the enclosure and into the inside of the cup. So you'd line the hole in the cup up with the hole in the enclosure, squirt the glue through, and then when the glue was starting to solidify a little bit, I'd squish down the sides and almost make like a glue rivet to hold that in place. And then what I would do is cut another cup off, same way, and drop that into the cup that's mounted so it was like a holder for the cup. And that way I could fill it with water. And if it became too soiled, I could pluck that out without reaching my hand too deeply into the enclosure and just replace it with another cup. It worked great for me. So, you know, again, several inches of substrate in there, cork bark. At that point, I was using the cork bark flats, but I tried to get the ones that were a little curved, put it to the back of the enclosure at an angle, maybe some plastic foliage on it, sphagnum moss behind it, water dish up top, keep the substrate moist for slings. I would keep the substrate always moist for my juveniles and put them in there. Now, why I steered away from them is because the containers themselves, rounded corners, but more rectangular in shape. The opening to the top is a screw-on plastic top that is circular in shape. So what you ended up with when you took the top and opened it up were 4 corners that allowed spaces for when you were trying to get the spider out of the enclosure. A lot of times, sometimes what happens, the spider would get into those corners, squish itself all up, and it would be very difficult to get the spider out. I ended up having to burn holes into, because I'd use a soldering iron to make the holes in it originally. I'd put holes in all four corners eventually so that I could take a paintbrush when the spider ended up hung up there and kind of poke it to try to get it down. But it kind of, when I was doing, a lot of what I kept in those were Salmopea species and Pisolotheria species. I had the Lampropelma species in them. Those aren't ones you really want to have an obstructed egress for the spider when you're trying to get it out. You don't want a situation where the spider is going to go, instead of going out the round hole, get hung up in those corners, which makes it difficult. So I kind of moved away from them. That's not to say they still don't work. I still have two brand new ones in my garage that I was eyeing that I may bring back into play again because they did work nice. It was all about the rehousings. I'm all about the safe rehousings, and that was an extra obstacle. It was kind of a pain in the butt to get around during rehousing. So nowadays, what I end up using for most of my juvenile arboreals and fossorial species are the food storage containers that you get on Amazon. You can buy them, I think it's like $30 for a pack of four sometimes. But what I love about them is that they're very open in the top. The top is like one big piece of plastic with four little flaps that clip down into place. You take that off. I like, when working with the more high-strung arboreal species, I like a top opening enclosure that allows me a lot of room. I don't want to find myself in a situation where my hands are crammed in a small opening with a fast moving, potentially defensive spider. So I prefer that. They're easy to ventilate. Nowadays, I use a drill. I just go down there and drill a bunch of rows of holes all the way around. Very simple if you have a cheap drill to do that and make them appropriate. The one drawback, and people will come on and go, they're kind of milky. They are made out of the same type of plastic that like the Sterilite containers are made out of. So they're not crystal clear. Although I'm looking over at my shelves right now, and I can see the spiders clear as day. Two of them right out in the open sitting on them. So they're not that bad. But again, some folks don't like the milky enclosures. For me, when they're adults, that's when I'm going to put my money into a nice enclosure to display them. When they're juveniles, they're not going to be in there all that long. I'm not really worried about it. So these measure 7.5 inches by 7.5 inches by 9.1 inches or 19 by 19 by 23.1 centimeters. Again, perfect for arboreals, for fossorials. When I set them up, I put in about 3 to 4 inches of moist substrate. Cork bark. I wanted to use cork bark rounds in these, and we'll talk about that in a minute for tips for rehousing Pisolotheria. But unfortunately, I only had one good cork bark round left that was appropriately sized for it. The other ones were huge. It wasn't going to work. So I broke up some larger cork bark rounds. So at least instead of it being flat and leaned against the enclosure, it's kind of concaved. And I put that part of the cork bark against it, so it makes kind of a little tunnel behind it. And then once again, shove some sphagnum in there. Shove some sphagnum. If you're using the cork bark round, I put sphagnum moss in the cork bark round a bit, make a little hole, and I also put some underneath it because I've had some, unfortunately, not use the actual cork bark round itself that go into it to use it as a hide. They go around it or underneath it, so I put it there. I got some leaf litter because it looks pretty. And then I got a water dish just set. It's the 5-ounce deli cups just set on the ground. I think that's about it for the setup for those. But I like them. They work great. They're clean looking. They're easy to set up. They're cheap. And they'll hold the spider until it gets to be about 4 inches or so. So we're going to get a few molts out of these guys before they have to be put into something else. And when it comes time to rehouse them, that Simply Limeade thing that I use works beautifully for getting them into the Simply Limeade container because it slips. These have kind of rounded corners on them. The Simply Limeade container kind of is that square base with the slightly rounded corners. It fits perfectly down over the spider. So if you use these, get yourself a Simply Limeade container. It's going to be your best friend. Put all those holes in so you can get in there with whether it be chopsticks or a paintbrush, and it'll make your life a lot easier when you have to rehouse them. So in the video, we told beforehand, Billy and I, before our videos, always discuss how I see it working out. So I always go, ideally, this is what I would like to happen. However, if that doesn't work, then we do this, this, and this. And that way, it's kind of a nice way for us to mentally prep for any situation that should pop up during the rehousing. And in another way, it kind of allows me, Billy to kind of have an idea of what I'm doing so she can follow with the camera. Because she has the most difficult job, I think, having to kind of move and be able to switch gears quickly. If I suddenly go, all right, this isn't going to work, we're doing this, she has to be able to get in there with it. So we talked about it ahead of time. I go, I'm hoping what will happen is we'll be able to pick either the hole. They had a big mass of webbing and around their cork bark. I said, maybe what we'll be able to do is just pick up the cork bark, have all the webbing come up, the spider attached to it, and drop it in the new enclosure. And it did go fairly close to that. When we opened up the spider enclosure, we had the bright lights on. and the spiders immediately went down in their burrows, but all three of them stayed on the piece of cork bark. So when I went to pull all the stuff out, only the cork bark came out, but the spider sat right on the cork bark, calm as can be, scrunched up, using, probably thinking it's using its natural camouflage. I can't see it. And I just carefully took the cork bark, moved it over the new enclosure, dropped the cork bark in it. That gave it a little spot to hide behind. And Billy got some good footage of them because they just sat there. It was great. And I was so glad, because every rehousing we do, we always, you know, we hope for the best, plan for the worst. I hope for the best because I don't want a situation where I'm going to cause more anxiety for somebody who is looking to rehouse their animal. And what I mean by that is a lot of folks come to me to watch my videos on rehousing. And I've had them tell me this. I have something I want to rehouse. I'm freaking out about it. I go over and watch yours. It goes so calm. And that makes me realize it can be a calm rehousing. It gives me the confidence I need to approach this rehousing with a calm and clear head. And I love that. That's the reason I do these. So always in the back of my mind, I don't want a debacle, because I don't want somebody to come on and go, all right, I gotta rehouse my juvenile ornatus. Let's see how it goes with Tom. Oh no, Tom couldn't even keep him under control. I know that line of thinking will be there for somebody there present, for somebody that would see me have to wrestle with a recalcitrant spider that's not doing what I want to do. But on the other hand, I'm always thinking, all right, if something does go wrong and doesn't quite go to plan, it's a great way to show folks, hey, look it, we're still calm. It's okay. Billy sometimes freaks out a little bit, but usually I'm like, all right, here we go, let's take a step back for a minute. This happened with my Salmopius ecclesiasticus. It kind of came out, went on a little walkabout, and we showed how calm as can be. Just let the spider calm down. We got it right back into his closure. Everything was fine. So I was really secretly hoping that things would go super well, because this is one of the species, again, that's talked about as being a little more high strung, possibly defensive. I will admit my slings have been, or my juveniles were a bit crazy. Anytime I'd open up the enclosure to feed them, they kind of sprint all around the enclosure. And I think part of that was due to the fact that the enclosure was a more shallow enclosure. So in the back of my mind, it's like, all right, here's what we hope is going to happen. Here's what may happen. But it went really well. All three of them went in with no problem whatsoever. We just picked up the cork bark. We're able to show how carefully I put the cup over top of it. That's one thing. I'm not a big fan of having the spider out with nothing catching it. I made that very clear. I've had people go, because I know there are people out there that demonstrate, you just poke them, they go where you want to. That's great. Some of them will, but if a spider should bolt, if there's a gust of wind, if somebody should happen to breathe on it, the spider can bolt, and then you have nothing. Now you have a spider out and about. And for somebody who has practice rehousing and doesn't panic, not a big deal. For somebody that's watching somebody that has that practice do it, and suddenly, oh no, this didn't work the way it was planned, that is a big deal. And I've had folks tell me recently that they've tried that method where they just kind of poke, the spider's calm, and then the spider overshot the enclosure, they panic, the spider panic, it turns into a nightmare. So that's why I always have that catch cup there. So when I picked up the cork bark, I put the catch cup over it. Worst case scenario, if the spider started to move, I put the spider down in the catch cup, put the spider down, let it settle down. Didn't happen though. They sat right out in the open. Billy got some great footage of them. Later on, they went back behind their cork bark and they've already done some webbing, some digging, and created nice little hides. Now, while we're talking about rehousings, a few tips that work for, honestly, any of the faster arboreal species, but these are ones I use with Pisolatheria, and they work great, and they can save you a lot of trouble and a lot of stress when rehousing. Because somebody came on, and I talked about one technique, and they're like, oh, I thought that would be considered cheating, or I kind of thought of it as cheating. There's no cheating. We work smarter, not harder here when it comes to rehousing. Everything's about making that transition as safe as possible for the spider and the keeper. So number one, if you're keeping the spiders in a 32-ounce deli cup or something with a little bit of height, you can always wait. There's one molt where the spiders hit around 3.5 inches. A 3.5-inch Pisolatheria species can be put into an adult enclosure and do quite well. I know we talk a lot about making sure that we don't drop smaller specimens into big enclosures so they're swimming in them and can't find prey, but I found that overall, Pisolatheria are very active hunters, and if you put them in a larger enclosure, although it may seem like they're swimming in, I would definitely put in a couple different hides. I wouldn't just put in one hide, I'd put in a couple different hides. I put in some plants, fake plants or real plants, whatever you prefer, to give them some coverage so they can be a little more bold when they go out to hunt. But it's not, I don't think it's a bad thing to put, usually, I should probably say, usually it's around the 3.5 to 4 inch mark that I will put them in the adult enclosures. There's one molt in particular where they hit 3.5 to 4 inches. That's a good size spider. right into the adult enclosure if you want. The other thing kind of along the same lines of this is if you have them in that 32-ounce deli cup and you want to put them into the adult enclosure, there's nothing wrong with popping the top of that deli cup, leaning it over in a corner against one of the cork bark hides you put into your adult enclosure, letting it come out on its own. I've had people go, oh, it's cheating. It's not cheating. Should you know how to rehouse a spider? Absolutely. But in a situation like that, if you can fit the old enclosure into the new one, why not? It's just saving time. I've done it before where, you know, I record the majority of my rehousings, but every once in a while, it's like I'll record a rehousing of one specimen I have, and I have another of the same species, and that one I just go quickly like, all right, we're going to get this done with. I've got the tarantulas to feed, so I'll take the top off the cover, put it in its old enclosure, let it come out on its own. Works great. Another good technique to use, cork bark tubes. For years, I used cork bark flats. They can work. They work fine. But I've gravitated more to using tubes with my Piscelatheria and my Somopia species. Cork bark tubes are wonderful because A, they provide the spider with a lot of cover. They love to get in those tubes, make a little area. They'll dig a little bit down, do some webbing around it, and they hunt from the tubes. It's fun to watch. And the spider feels secure, and you have less of a chance of the spider bolting because it's going to hunt from that tube. It's going to come out, grab the thing, go right back in the tube. The other good part about the tube is because they're in those tubes and they feel secure, it's very easy when rehousing one to just pick the tube up with a pair of tongs. Sometimes if you do it, you can take a piece of cardboard and just cover the top of it to make sure the spider doesn't bolt out, but usually it's not going anywhere. It's dark in there. It feels safe. It's not going to boogie on you, and you can take that tube out, bring it carefully over to the new enclosure, drop it right in. Voila, you're done. Your spider is rehoused. And that was the one the guy came in. He's like, I do this, and I thought it was cheating. Nope, that's working smart. And the best part is you've already got it's pre-set up with a burrow or a den or a hide. Like you put that cork bark tube in there. What it's going to do is it'll stay in there until it starts to outgrow it, and then it'll go out and kind of expand, web around, pull up those dirt curtains, and probably move into hopefully one of the other two or three cork bark tubes or areas you have in there to continue into a home that's a little more appropriate for its size. So the cork bark tube trick looks great. When I rehouse, I also, because this is a faster species, I use the crumpled paper towels in the corners. Remember, when tarantulas get out and they're caught out in the open, they will sometimes race around the enclosures as they try to find a secure place to hide. If you put crumpled up paper towels in the corner, I've had tarantulas that they race. They go underneath those paper towels. Suddenly, the lights cut down a bit. The airflow is cut down a bit. They feel secure, and you can carefully remove the paper towel, cup them, and get them where they need to be. I even had one, I think, once it was gripping to the paper towel, and I just picked the paper towel up and put it in the new enclosure. Easy as pie. The other thing you can think about when rehousing, they are afraid that most of them are a bit photosensitive. They don't like bright lights. So if you're out there with bright lights like I am because you're recording or you got bright lights, you can see the spider and see what you're doing, they're going to shy away from that. So when you set up your new enclosure, the trick is to make sure there are dark spots inside that enclosure, either inside the cork bark round is a good one. But what I like to do is take a piece of cardboard from a box and cut it so I have two sides of the box that are connected. So it makes like picture opening a book. It's like that. And I put that in the corner by where I have my cork bark, so it makes a nice, dark, shady spot in the back of the enclosure. And then when I get the spider, if it's in the catch cup or whatever I may have it in, I can direct the spider to that dark spot when I prod it out of the catch cup, and usually they'll go right in and hide. It's wonderful. This is the trick I used when I rehoused. I think it was like 8 Piscelatheria metallicas I had together in a communal, and we were very worried about putting one in and having it bolt while we're getting the other ones. Nope, we created a shadowy spot behind it, put some cork bark leaning up against it so it was completely dark behind it, and I just steered the spiders into that area, and they all went into that area and stayed put. So there's another trick for you. So some things you can use, some tricks you can employ when rehousing that should make rehousing your Piscelatheria species much less stressful for you and for the spider. So now we have them rehoused into their juvenile enclosures. I have folks go, what do you put an adult into? For years, I used the Sterilite containers. The big Sterilite bins are about 12 and a half inches tall by 10 inches wide by like 14 inches long or so. And over the years, I've had folks come out and go, well, why are you giving it that much floor space? There is nothing wrong. I think we talked about this in an earlier podcast. There's nothing wrong with giving your tarantula, your arboreal, more floor space. Like, who cares? The idea is to have some height so it can get off the ground. Obviously, we're not going to be able to replicate where they may be found in the wild, where sometimes they're 6, 7, 8 feet, maybe even higher off of the ground in a tree. That's not really feasible in a collection, but we want to make sure that they have some height so they can get off the ground, but there's nothing wrong with giving them some floor space. So I use these for a while because I like the layout. I like the fact that you can take the top off. It gives you a lot of space to work in. You put the cork bark rounds in there. You can put plants and you can do it with the whole nine. Lately, I've moved into putting them into nicer things. I've had folks ask, can you put them in one of the, 8x8x12 inch or 20.32 by 20.32 by 30.5 inch. I think that's what it is. Exoterra, what is it, nano tall? I think that's way too small for a potentially 10-inch spider. I mean, if you wanted to use that for maybe a juvenile, that would work. If you want to put them in a pretty juvenile enclosure, that's great. But I think if you're looking at housing one of these beasts, you're going to need one of the ones that measures 12 by 12 by, I think, 18 inches, the Exoterra Mini Talls. They, I think, 30.5 by 30.5 by 46 centimeters. Those are what I would look at. I have my 9-inch Peace Letheria Rufalata in one, and she's got plenty enough room. Unfortunately, she killed the plant. And I mentioned this in the video. If you want to set them up, you want to give them a cork bark round or two. You want to give them some foliage to hide behind. And I put a big, beautiful pothos in there. I did let it. Somebody came on and was like, you got to let the stuff settle in first. I had this plant in there for months doing great. The spider, unfortunately, trampled it, ripped leaves off, and killed it. Now it's dead, and now there's a big empty spot where I'm going to need to put a fake one in. So when people see this one again, and it's a fake plant, don't judge me. It's just I want to give it some coverage. Usually, I also put the background on. You can buy the cork backgrounds that you can basically use. I use black, the aquarium silicone, to glue it to the back of the enclosure, and it gives it some, if you put a cork bark against that or cork bark rounds, it gives it some, again, privacy and a dark area to hide behind. But a lot of times I come down in broad daylight, she's sitting sprawled right out on that, looking beautiful. And when my ornatas grow up, if I get females, that's what they'll be going into. So something around that size. I know other things, other companies make enclosures, the Arachnosis enclosures, they have big arboreal ones that would work great with it. They'll be a little pricey, but they're beautiful enclosures. I'm not sure if the ones over in the U.S. are making giant cages because they're probably cost prohibitive for a 12 by 12 by 18, but keep a lookout. There's so many of these acrylic ones popping up right and left. I'm sure somebody's going to make one. It's just going to be pricey, but there is stuff out there you can use. I've never used, I'll mention this because somebody always mentions it, the when you take the 10-gallon tank and you convert it, those can work great. I mean, there's not a lot of airflow from the sides of the tank, obviously, but I've seen people do it where they put a lot of airflow from the front. If you had a fan going in the room, it shouldn't be an issue. But that's where you take the 10-gallon, you stand it on its side, and they use plexiglass to build like a hinge opening. They do a litter dam on the bottom, like 4 or 5 inches up, hinge it, piece of plexiglass that folds down. I'm not the biggest fan of the front opening ones, but that's personal preference. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just not what I prefer, but those could work as well. So you're going to need something, obviously, if it's 10 inches, they're big. And unlike, I was talking to somebody about this, we often talk about with terrestrial species, oh, the spider's 9 inches. How are you going to keep it in a 10-gallon tank? Well, remember, when terrestrials are walking around, they rarely spread all the way out. They're usually take your hand, spread it out, now crunch your fingers down like you're making a spider. That drastically reduces the footprint size of that spider. So something that's 9 inches suddenly goes down to about 5.5, 6 inches or so. And that's something always to keep in mind, that means a 10-gallon tank isn't too big for the spider because they're not laid out, sprawled out, unless they just had a molt and they're doing the old tarantula yoga and stretching. The difference is with arboreal species, they do stretch out. They'll sit on that side of that enclosure. They'll sit on the back of it. They'll sit on the cork bark, and they stretch completely out and flatten out. So that is where you have to pay a little more attention to the size of the tarantula's footprint to make sure that you have an appropriately sized enclosure. Because again, if you have a spider that has the potential to be a little more skittish, a little more bold, a little more potentially defensive, the trick is to give it room. Make sure the spider has room so you don't come into a situation where the spider is too big for the enclosure. You've got a cramped environment. You're putting your hands in there. You're putting yourself at risk because if the spider does bolt, there's nowhere to go but onto you or onto your hand. You don't want a situation like that. So give it some room, but make sure if you give it room, give it coverage. This is something I needed to do better with as I got into the hobby. I would create these enclosures that work for the spiders, and I didn't have any issues with behaviors or anything. But as I spent more time in the hobby, I realized the more foliage, fake foliage stuff I can put in there, the more the spider is going to feel confident to come out a little bit and explore from its burrow. So definitely something to keep in mind. But again, I haven't had any issues with the behaviors in mine, and I think the trick is I give them their space. So for most folks, I don't think you're going to experience that defensive behavior. Now, moisture, I know I talked about slings, I keep moist. Juveniles, I keep them moist. They are rather adaptable spiders overall, but I do keep part of the substrate moist at all times. And water dishes, big water dishes are great. If you really want to make sure that your spider's always got that moisture it needs to keep those book lungs nice and moist, put a big water dish in, a big open water dish. And I have had times in the winter where things have dried out a little bit, and I find the spider sitting right over the water dish, meaning it's searching for that moist, more moist environment to keep those book lungs working properly. And as far as temperatures are concerned, temperatures here are usually in the summertime. They are high 70s to mid 80s. So that would be around 25.6 Celsius to 29.44 Celsius, around there. So that's a good window. And that's where they were kept in the summertime. In the wintertime, it gets a little cooler in here. So we're talking about temperatures around usually 72 to 74 degrees, although it has dropped into the 60s. And when I first started keeping Peace Letharia species, my room was down in the 60s. So it could drop to around 66 to 68 degrees Fahrenheit, or around 19 to 20 degrees Celsius. So I had no problem. Grew them up. They ate great. They still grew in those cooler temperatures. But usually they're right around the 74 degree mark in here, or 23.33 Celsius during the wintertime or so. So those are my temps. You don't need to heat them. They don't need to be kept super warm. I know they come from warm areas. I know there's folks out there who say they have to be at this temperature. I totally disagree. However, if you keep them warmer, expect faster growth. We've always talked about that. Warmer temperatures lead to a faster metabolism, lead to a faster growing spider. However, do recognize that the faster your spider grows, these are ones that are anywhere from 10 to 14 years old is usually the lifespan of them. And I think that's impacted, especially with a shorter lifespan of the tarantula overall. I mean, it's not a terribly short one, but if you grow a sling up like I did with my Regalis from an inch to 4 inches or 5 inches in a year, that's really fast growth rate, and that's fairly close. Like, that's a quick march to sub-adulthood. You may shave some years off the life afterwards, but awesome spiders, beautiful spiders, ones I wish people wouldn't ignore. Well, again, it's weird. People are like, I'm grabbing one. I haven't had any experience with spiders. I'm grabbing a pure or not. I just think you're beautiful. And it's like, well, slow your roll, buddy. Let's get some experience in there first. And then I have other people that go, I love Peace Letharia species, but the pure or not and the P. rufolata scare the heck out of me. And again, I get it. When you have something that's that big, has even just the fangs would hurt, but you throw in that venom and they're fast, that can be a scary proposition. And as far as feeding is concerned, I know I talked about sling feeding. Juveniles, you know, you're talking something that's an inch and 3/4 or so. They'll take down medium crickets, usually no problem. Medium red runner roaches. You generally use dubia roaches for them, because the dubia roaches, I've had a hard time with the spiders not finding the dubias. Even when I crush their heads and send them in there as zombies, sometimes they miss them and I find them rotten later. It happened just this summer. I went to feed my P. rufolata molted and she was super thin. I was trying to fatten her up. So I dropped a male in there, and usually the males wander around. She missed it, ended up in the water dish dead. I put a female in, crushed its head. I found it later on rotten in a corner. So I don't use a lot of dubia. That's where you see people feeding dubia. They tong feed, and I just don't like the tong feed. It's not my thing. People that do it, fine. It can work for them. I just don't tong feed. I did have better luck with the males, though. So the male B. dubia, I think mine's eaten three of them now. I dropped them in right in the top of her cork bark. She was hiding in it and she grabbed them, no problem. But just be aware with the dubia that they can play dead, they can burrow, and the spider might not get them. If I'm feeding crickets, I drop in, you know, 4 or 5 big fat crickets or so. If it's after a molt and the spider is super thin in the abdomen, then I will feed them multiple times a week just until that spider fattens up a bit. But that's it. They're not that difficult to keep. They're very, very hardy. They're beautiful. They're fast growing and they're shy. Most of them are very, very shy. I think the ones that are defensive, that's the exception to the rule. Now, if somebody's out there thinking, well, I don't even want to take the chance of having that exceptional spider that might be a little more spunky, I totally understand. I'm not here to force people or to guilt people into getting them. I'm here to provide the information you need to grow them up and to provide the most accurate account of what you can expect behavior-wise. And that's, I think, the most accurate account I can give. So there we go. This will work with both. Honestly, everything I talked about here would work with any species of Peace Letharia. But as far as, you know, the adult enclosure, they do get large. You're going to want a bigger enclosure somewhere down the line for them. So that does it for that. Now, a little addendum to this one. I posted the video up, and at the end of the video, I think it was the end of the video in my outro, I mentioned the fact that it might have been the beginning. Anyway, one of the spots where I'm sitting there and it's my dumb face on the screen for a length of time, I talked about the fact how the Sri Lankan Peace Letharia species, that's Peace Letharia fasciata ornata, Smithy, Subfusca, both Highland and Lowland, and Vitata, you cannot legally sell them across state lines. You can give them away as a gift, a legitimate gift, like Emil did for me. It was, here, Tom, you can have these spiders. Here is a letter showing that I understand the law and I'm handing them over. You can give away species to breed. So if I want to give my mail away to somebody, no problem there. It can go across state lines. You can't sell them. And what happens is, and this has happened a few times, and it's still happening from what I'm hearing, there are tarantula dealers out there. Some, sadly, will just sell them flat out. They'll put on their website, these can only be sold in the state that we currently reside in, whatever it may be, Florida, North Carolina. You can only buy this species if you're in our state. But then somebody will put it in their cart and they'll go, oops, and they'll send it off, which drives me nuts because we know darn well somebody, you want to think somebody packing them should be aware, even if you hired somebody to pack for you, hey, by the way, if somebody orders a pokey, double check. If it's out of state, we can't send it out. This, you know, here's the list of species, but they'll do it that way. The other thing that people were doing them is putting them in mystery boxes. So be like, hey, you're buying a mystery box, $250. Surprise, you got a fasciata. Surprise, you got an ornata. And they thought that was a slick way of getting around it, even though we knew very early on when we double checked with Fish and Wildlife, that doesn't count. That is part of a sale. You are exchanging money. That spider is part of a sale. Therefore, it's being sold, it doesn't count. So a lot of people will do it like that or send them as freebies as part of an order. You can't do that. If they really want to legally do it, I think there was a company out there that was told that this was a big no-no. And what they did was they shipped the spiders out separately for free with apparently no strings attached. If they're eating the shipping on it, that's a free spider, that's a gift. But you cannot do that. And unfortunately, I mentioned, or unfortunately, I don't care. This one really irritated me, quite frankly. I put at the end of the video, if you have received one of these illegally, you think it's illegally, let me know because I'm keeping track of it. And it's not that I'm running, I think some people think I'm sitting there like with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, here's the ones. No, it's nothing like that. I'm not recommending any dealer that does this. And if somebody says why, I'm saying because I'm privy to the fact they're doing illegal activities. That's it. If you don't like it, tough crap, honestly. And somebody came on and posted, Tom, don't be a piece of Letharius snitch. Mind your own business. And it pissed me off bad. Like, I mind my own business. This impacts the entire hobby. And let me point out that the first person I called out for doing this was that scumbag Dustin that had Simply Spiders. That, as you can see, I have a hard time even talking about the guy without getting upset. Where I did a podcast about it, I called him out. I didn't name him, but I left enough information out there that people can figure it out. I could have basically blew his whole thing apart, and I tried to be professional about it and give him a chance to back down. He didn't. He went on a terrible podcast by Tarantula Collective, where they basically bashed me the entire time, and it irritated me to no end, but I kept quiet about it because I'm like, this guy is a scumbag, and he's going to be doing other illegal things. I was privy that he did a lot of illegal things, and look what ended up happening with it. He came out, he screwed a bunch of people over, a bunch of people lost a bunch of money on it, and it was disgusting. He was allowed to remain in business, even though we had evidence that he was shady, because bottom line, if you're a reputable dealer, you shouldn't be doing things blatantly breaking U.S. law. Whether you agree with it or not, you can sit there. I love the ones that sit there and go, oh, I'm just trying to keep Peace Letharia in the hobby. I just don't want to. No, you're not. You're making money because you can charge a lot of money for these, and you can sell off your little gift boxes or whatever because people know they're going to get one of these. So that was the first incident. The other one, I was putting together a podcast about Arisa Spider Shop because they were sending these things out right and left. They were just letting people order them online. So I was about to say, hey, by the way, there's another dealer, and once again, supported by another YouTuber that was getting free stuff from them and selling them to everybody. And then luckily that one blew up before I had to say anything, so I didn't have to put myself in the under fire again from people that don't understand how this stuff works. So that's two of them that were doing that illegally that, look, lo and behold, they had immoral business practices and screwed a lot of people over. So let's, if you look at the bigger picture of it, anybody that's doing that right now knows darn well it's illegal. And if you're, I've said this before, pick your poison. Either number one, you're selling tarantulas and you're too lazy or too ignorant to go out and research the laws and you're doing this completely by accident, which means you shouldn't be selling them because you don't know what you're doing in the first place. Get out of the hobby. Number two, you know exactly what you're doing and sometimes you're tricking people into buying something illegally that don't know any better. Because the bottom line is people go on a website, they expect that whoever's selling them something is reputable enough not to sell them an illegal spider. So I will get emails from people going, Tom, I'm kind of freaking out here. I just received a spider. I ordered a gift box from so-and-so, and I won't say the names again. And I opened it up and I realized they sent me a piece of Lotharia ornata. And I was so excited until I did some research and realized I'm in a different state and they sent it to me illegally. And then they're upset and they're scared and they're asking me, should I contact U.S. Fish and Wildlife about it? It's a crappy situation. So the person I responded, I struggle with these sometimes because I really got pissed off. I might have sworn even. It just really struck me the wrong way. Like, not my business. I've spent 10 years of my life trying to help people in this hobby. I love spiders. I love the hobby. I work with a lot of reputable dealers. And I'm, like a lot of people out there, am seeing the writing on the wall, seeing that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife will pass something like this. The people that are responsible for passing it are on our message boards. They're part of our Facebook groups. They're seeing people flaunting this stuff when they get it illegally. And they're taking note. If we can't follow the rules they give us, guess what? That's going to lead to more rules and more restrictive laws in the future. And a lot of us feel like it's coming. And in a way, we kind of deserve it because we just can't seem to go, all right, you know what? This sucks. We can't sell these across state lines, but we can make this work. We have people like Emil and Aaron out there doing the Tarantula Sustainment Project, trying to make sure we're playing this by the rules and showing them, look, we can play the game correctly. And then people go out there and do this. So yeah, it's my business. I've spent years doing this. I love Peace Lotharia. I'm in a teeny tiny state where it's difficult to get these species now. And I don't like going out and soliciting gifts. You guys know my thought on that. I feel icky doing it. And the only way I can get these now is if somebody like Emil, out of the goodness of his heart, goes, hey, you know what? I have a batch of them. Here you go. Here are some. So yes, 100% my business. Am I snitching? No, I'm not telling anybody. And usually if I cover it in a podcast, I try to keep it kind of, I mean, obviously, people can figure stuff out, but I'm not blowing them up. I could blow stuff up. It's very easy to do. I have platforms to do it, and I choose to put it out there in a way that people are informed, and hopefully the person involved hears it and changes it. And I know for a fact there's been instances where people have listened to that podcast, they've mentioned stuff like this, and they've changed their way of doing business. So is it my business? 100%. Am I sitting there, this snitch crap, what are we, in high school? Knock it off. Like, am I reporting people? No. Am I giving people the best information that I can? Yes. So that means if somebody says, hey, Tom, I'm currently in shopping for spiders, and I notice this dealer has something. What do you know about them? I will share, without getting into great detail, I would shy away from them. They've been known, whether knowingly or not, to engage in shady business practices. That's it. Anybody has a problem with that? I honestly don't care. It's like, we don't need you in the hobby. We need to start doing things correctly. I know we all want to. I've gotten this big argument with a guy who said, I'm destroying the hobby because these dumb laws should be ignored and you're prohibiting people from having these spiders. No, I'm trying to show that we can do things the right way. We can discuss till we're blue in the face. And I told you, I'm not even going to argue it and debate it because I don't agree with some of the stuff that's been passed. We can discuss it until we're blue in the face. It doesn't change the fact that it's illegal and that by doing this illegal stuff and tarantula people, they love sharing when they get something. So it's not even, it's not like people are getting these and not talking about it. I've seen people hint, yeah, I got it from this guy at a show. We're in a different state and it's public. So yeah, I will continue to take notes on people that are doing this. I have notes. I just got contacted not that long. Actually, few months ago by somebody who bought something at a show and they were able to buy one of these species even though they were out of state and they were like, I know I wasn't supposed to do it and he knew he wasn't supposed to do it. It's still happening, but if it's a legitimate dealer doing it, you should be asking yourself if they're willing to do that, if they're willing to put their business on the line, break the law to sell some pokies, which aren't even the best sellers out there, what else are they willing to do? Are they willing to brown box, which is disgusting and shouldn't be happening? Are they willing to, I don't know, sell a bunch of pre-orders for spiders that they never get in and then take everybody's money and move to another state? Or close down a dealership and then go to another guy and say, hey, would you like to work with us and reopen there under a different name? I wouldn't want to give those people my business. If you want to do it, so be it. But don't get mad at me when I call this type of stuff out. So there's my little rant. It feels good being able to say it. Billy had to listen to it right afterwards. A lot of times I'll get comments that pop up when I'm, you know, I put a video up, a comment will pop up, and I'll actually see the comment go up on my phone. And this was one that I looked at, and I'm like, is this guy joking? And even if he was joking, it just didn't strike me as funny. Like, that's ridiculous. Mind my own business. This is my business. I spent years of my life and time trying to help people out this. It's definitely my business. So that will do it for this one. Thank you for listening to me, Ben. A lot of people come on, they say that I'm their therapy. They go on, they listen to me talk about spiders, helps them calm down. Thank you guys this time. You guys paid it back to me by listening to me gripe about this. But That'll do it for this one. As always, you can find me on tomsbigspiders.com. You can find me on Tom's Big Spiders, the podcast. You can find me on Lunchboxes. That one's for you, Eric. And you can't find me on Lunchboxes. Maybe someday. YouTube, obviously, if you want to check out the Ornatas, please pop over. Again, I'm not sitting there saying please do it so I can get views. It's just if you want to see the rehousings, because sometimes these are, when you're talking about rehousings, it's sometimes better to see it in practice. It's more informative. It's more useful. Feel free to pop over or don't. Either way, if you pop over and you liked it, let me know. Guys, stay safe. We'll catch you all next time.